One of the other readings that encouraged people to do was the shorter discourse on the lion's roar. But I thought to before we go there, I thought to go just from the say the questions that have been coming up and the where the discussion's been going. To maybe backtrack a bit and come back to again, what is the what is the purpose or say the argument of the for the purpose of the anatta thesis or the argument for the anatta thesis? There's two main aspects that it illuminates or highlights, and one in the sense that it demonstrates the selfless nature of the five aggregates, five khandhas, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. On the grounds that they're not susceptible to the exercise of mastery. You can't make them comply with your wishes as much as you would like to. It doesn't work. And if anything is to really count as our quote-unquote self, this is our self, this is our true self, this is who I really am, it should at least be subject to our volitional control. It'd be nice. But since we can't really bend the five khandhas to our will, then they're subject to affliction. When they're subject to affliction, then therefore you can't really call it as self. So that's the logic of the Buddha. And there's a nice discourse where that illustrates that. Majjhima 35, Chula Sacchaka Sutta, Sacchaka, who is a follower of Nigantha, is another religious sect at the time of the Buddha of practitioners. He's known as a quote-unquote debater and a clever speaker. He meets up with Asaji, who is one of the first five disciples, somewhere in a park or something, and he heard that he questioned Asaji. Asaji told him that the Buddha, he wanted to know what the Buddha's teaching was, and heard that the Buddha teaches a doctrine of not self in relation to the five khandhas, and Sacchaka finds this disagreeable, and offers to defeat the Buddha in debate, and to quote detach him from that evil view unquote. Then he meets up with the Buddha. There's actually. He was kind of bragging ahead of time he was making this statement to the Vaisali assembly. I see no recluse or Brahman, the head of an order, the head of a group, the teacher of a group, even one claiming to be accomplished and fully enlightened, who would not shake, shiver, and tremble and sweat under the armpits if he were to engage in debate with me. Even if I were to engage a senseless post in debate, it would shake, shiver, and tremble if it were to engage in debate with me. So what shall I say of a human being? So he's pretty confident in himself. And so anyway, he goes, he meets the Buddha, and of course all sorts of the townsfolk have heard of this, and they're watching the come to witness this. And he's continuing to brag here, because he's telling everybody, come forth, good Lichavis, come forth. Today there will be some conversation between me and the recluse Gotama. If the recluse Gotama maintains before me what was maintained before me by one of his famous disciples, the bhikkhu named Asaji, then just as a strong man might seize a long-haired ram by the hair and drag him to and drag him fro and drag him round about, so in debate I will drag the recluse Gotama to and drag him fro and drag him round about. Just as a strong brewer's workman might throw a big brewer's sieve into a deep water tank and, taking it by the corners, drag it to and drag it fro and drag it round about, so in debate I will drag the recluse Gotama to and drag him fro and drag him round about. So he says, just as a strong brewer's mixer might take a strainer by the corners and shake it down and shake it up and thump it about, so in debate I will shake the recluse Gotama down and shake him up and thump him about. Just as a 60-year-old elephant might plunge into a deep pond and enjoy playing the game of hemp washing, so I shall enjoy playing the game of hemp washing with the recluse Gotama. Come forth, good Lichavis, come forth. Today there will be some conversation between me and the recluse Gotama. So anyway, there are some who think he's... this is going to be a problem. Now that everybody wants to see. So anyway, the Buddha, he asks how does Master Gotama discipline his disciples, and how is Master Gotama's instruction usually presented to his disciples? This is how I discipline my disciples. Agivesana. Agivesana is his clan name. And this is how my instruction is usually presented to my disciples. Because material form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, formations are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. Because material form is not self, feeling is not self, perception is not self, formations are not self, consciousness is not self, all formations are impermanent, all things are not self. This is the way I discipline my disciples, and that is how my instruction is usually presented to my disciples. A simile occurs to me, Master Gotama. Explain how it occurs to you, Agivesana, the Blessed One said. Just as when seeds and plants, whatever their kind, reach growth, increase, and maturation, all do so in dependence upon the earth, based upon the earth, and just as when strenuous works, whatever their kind, are done, all are done in dependence upon the earth, based upon the earth. So too, Master Gotama, a person has material form as self, and based upon material form, he produces merit or demerit. A person has feeling as self, and based upon feeling, he produces merit or demerit. A person has perception as self, and based upon perception, he produces merit or demerit. A person has formations as self, and based upon formations, he produces merit or demerit. A person has consciousness as self, and based upon consciousness, he produces merit or demerit. Agivesana. Are you not asserting thus? Material form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, formations are myself, formations in the sense of mental formations. Consciousness is myself. I assert thus, Master Gotama, material form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, formations are myself, consciousness is myself. And so does this great multitude. What is this great multitude to do with you, Aghivesana? Please confine yourself to your own assertion alone. Then, Master Gotama, I assert thus. Material form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, formations are myself, consciousness is myself. In that case, Aghivesana, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose. What do you think, Aghivesana? Would a head-anointed noble king, for example, King Pasenadi of Kosala or King Ajatasattu Vedehiputta of Magadha, exercise the power in his own realm to execute those who should be executed, to fine those who should be fined, and to banish those who should be banished? Basically, it's setting up this. These kings have incredible power. They can do as they wish. Master Gotama, a head-anointed noble king, for example, King Pasenadi of Kosala or King Ajatasattu Vedehiputta of Magadha, would exercise the power in his own realm to execute those who should be executed, to banish those who should be banished. For even those oligarchic communities and societies, such as the Vajjayans and the Malians, those weren't kingdoms, they were more like small republics. For even these, the Vajjayans and Malians exercise the power in their own realm to execute those who should be executed, to fine those who should be fined, to banish those who should be banished. So all the more should a head-anointed noble king. He would exercise it, Master Gotama, and he would be worthy to exercise it. What do you think, Aghivesana, when you say thus, material form is myself, do you exercise any such power over that material form to say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus? When this was said, Satchika the Nigantha's son was silent. And he realized, uh-oh. A second time, the Blessed One asked the same question, a third time, so then that was pretty much the end of the debate. That's where, because that's the point that the Buddha is making, is that having this this power over our khandhas is what should define what is control in the control of self. There's a story of Ajahn Chah. One time when he was in England, and he relates it. He said, a woman asked me about how to deal with anger. I told her that the next time she gets angry, to set her alarm clock and put it in front of her, then to give herself 2 hours for the anger to go away. If it was really her anger, she could probably tell it to go away like this. In 2 hours, be gone. But it isn't really ours to command. Sometimes in 2 hours, it's still here. At other times, in less than an hour, it's gone. Holding on to anger as a personal possession will cause suffering. If it really belonged to us, it would have to obey us. And so that's a simple proposition. And that's one of the aspects of anatta in terms of its application, how to reflect on it, how to investigate it. See, if you can't really control it or command it or have it obey you, then it's not really who you are or what you are. The other aspect is it's actually in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta where the Buddha goes through a goes through the excuse me. That on the basis of the, let's say, the two characteristics of anicca and dukkha, when we take them conjointly, then we can deduce that this is what we say. So, like the Buddha in that sutta is by asking question, what do you think, bhikkhus? Is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent. Is what is impermanent satisfactory or unsatisfactory? Suffering or happiness? And it's unsatisfactory. Suffering, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering, subject to change, fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Venerable Sir. So it's sort of this, that's in conjunction with the, with these characteristics, then it demonstrates, say, when there's this quality of impermanence, quality of suffering, then those are inevitably not subject to or not worthy of picking up, this is mine, this is myself. So that, there's a lovely discourse that illustrates that. And it's not so long. I'd like to read the whole thing because it's quite a beautiful sutta, and how it's using the non-self as a strategy, but it's also it ties neatly how anicca, dukkha, anatta work together or function together to illuminate this sense of not self and to free the heart. Okay, this is Sanyutta 22, Sutta number 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Bhaggas at Sungsumaragira in the Besakala Grove, the deer park. Then the householder Nakulabhita approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, I am old, Venerable Sir, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage, afflicted in body, often ill. I rarely get to see the Blessed One and the bhikkhus worthy of esteem. Let the Blessed One exhort me, Venerable Sir, let him instruct me, since that would lead to my welfare and happiness for a long time. Nakulabhita is a there's actually Nakulabhita and Nakulamata, which is a their husband and wife, and when they first met the Buddha, they referred to him as their son, and the Buddha didn't refute it. And Ananda asked him after, "What the heck was that all about?" and he said, it's through familiarity, because in many previous lives I have been their son, and they so they held a real warm place in the Buddha's relationship with them, and there's actually many suttas where they show up. Okay, so it is, householder, so it is. This body of yours is afflicted, weighed down, encumbered. If anyone carrying around this body were to claim to be healthy even for a moment, what is that due to other than foolishness? Therefore, householder, you should train yourself thus. Even though I am afflicted in body, my mind will be unafflicted. Thus should you train yourself. Then the householder Nakulabhita, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's statement, rose from his seat, and having paid homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he approached the Venerable Sariputta. Having paid homage to the Venerable Sariputta, he sat down to one side, and the Venerable Sariputta then said to him, householder, your faculties are serene, your facial complexion is pure and bright. Did you get to hear a Dhamma talk today in the presence of the Blessed One? And it says, Sariputta, very savvy. Why not, Venerable Sir? Just now I was anointed by the Blessed One with the ambrosia of a Dhamma talk. With what kind of ambrosia of a Dhamma talk did the Blessed One anoint you, householder? And then he repeats the entire conversation. And then he said, it was with the ambrosia of such a Dhamma talk, Venerable Sir, that the Blessed One anointed me. And Sariputta, didn't it occur to you, householder, to question the Blessed One further as to how one is afflicted in body and afflicted in mind, and how one is afflicted in body but not afflicted in mind? And Sariputta, of course, is foremost in wisdom. He's wow, I can't believe you passed up that opportunity. And then Nikula Pita, we would come from far away, Venerable Sir, to learn the meaning of this statement from the Venerable Sariputta. It would be good indeed if the Venerable Sariputta would clear up the meaning of this statement. Then listen and attend closely, householder, I will speak. Yes, Venerable Sir. The householder Nikula Pita replied, the Venerable Sariputta said this. How, householder, is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind? Here, householder, the uninstructed worldling, Putujana, that was what I talked about earlier, the uninstructed worldling who is not a seer of the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who is not a seer of superior persons and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, regards form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. He lives obsessed by the notions, I am form, form is mine. As he lives obsessed by these notions, that form of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of form, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. He regards feeling as self, or self as possessing feeling, or feeling as in self, or self as in feeling. He lives obsessed by the notions, I am feeling, feeling is mine. As he lives obsessed by these notions, that feeling of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of feeling, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. And of course, the same for perceptions, the same for volitional formations, the same for consciousness. It is in such a way, householder, that one is afflicted in body and afflicted in mind. And how, householder, is one afflicted in body but not afflicted in mind? Here, householder, the instructed noble disciple, who is a seer of the noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, who is a seer of superior persons and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, does not regard form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. He does not live obsessed by the notions, I am form, form is mine. As he lives unobsessed by these notions, that form of his changes and alters. With the change and alteration of form, there do not arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. So the same is true with feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness. It is in such a way, householder, that one is afflicted in body but not afflicted in mind. This is what the Venerable Sariputta said. Elated, the householder Nikulapitta delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's statement. So it's a quite a, again, that sense of taking on how we take on these different forms of self-identity, self-identification. There's a as in again in that Machima 44 of that's the basis that stock phrase of regarding material form as self, self is possessed of material form is in self, self is in material form. Those are, that's a stock, and going through the five khandhas, It's a stock way of describing Sakaya Ditti. How does identity view come to be? It's through that identification with those five khandhas in those different ways. And similarly, how is it dissolved? It's through not perceiving that. And there's a so that sense of the in the commentaries they do give an illustration of those identity views, and they say that one regard material form as self in the way that the flame of a burning oil lamp is identical with the color of the flame. Or there's that assumption, well, because it's identical, then we identify with it, regard it as self. Or one may regard self as possessing material form as a tree possesses a shadow. But again, these are, illustrations or similes, trying to illustrate what that is referring to or feeling like. Regarding material form as in self, as the scent is in the flower, or one may regard self as in material form as a jewel is in a casket. So that's as images to carry, then those are how we, they're in a very material form, a way that there is that assumption of selfhood within those things. So that the sense of how the different qualities of anicca, dukkha, anatta are intertwined, and in particular, help one to recognize, well, what's the Buddha pointing to, alluding to, when he's saying anatta? What's it mean? What's the experience? So that these are ways of reflecting on that. So, any questions around that? Yes, Carol.
Just like, you know, just from what you're saying about like the scent and the flower and yeah. Sort of the other analogies, you know, it sounds like there is a it's relational.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's an effect. That gets it a little tricky.
It's not tricky in the sense that, but we take something that is relational, causally conditioned, and then extrapolate something separate and solid out of it. That's the purpose of those illustrations and seeing how we tend to do.
And also, it sounds like what you're saying is like everything's pointing back to sort of the third foundation of how we're experiencing reality, how we're the mind view, would you say?
Third foundation?
In terms of the Satipatthana, the third foundation of mindfulness, would you say? Just, you know, like the view of how we're perceiving.
I think one of the things that, like, with the, I wouldn't separate out the, obviously things are, it's like the very first verse of the Dhammapada, you know, all things are preceded by mind. So obviously, yeah, the mind plays a huge role, but then you can't really extrapolate mind out from as something separate from the five experience or the whole five khandhas, the whole ball of wax.
That sort of ties in. There was a talk a while ago when Ajahn Chah went to see Ajahn Mun, and the teaching Ajahn Mun gave him, if I recall it correctly, was that the most important thing, or a very important thing, is to be able to distinguish between mind and mind objects.
Yeah.
Is that mind that distinguishes between mind and mind objects, is it a development of ordinary mind, or is it something that as we develop wisdom, we become aware of a larger mind that we tap into?
Both of those are wrong. That's so important from the perspective of the Buddha's teachings, because we always want to, you know, we want to create something out of it. And it doesn't really matter what we call it. But the Buddha is asking, what's the effect? And how do we be free? And we don't actually be free and free ourselves from suffering until we're able to see, this arises. Oh, that's how that works. And the fact that the reality, of course, is that yes, there is mind, the ability to know, and the ability to see clearly. The problem is this our real mind? Is this our real self? What name can I have for it? What can I call it? That's the problem. And the problem isn't that we have mind, that we can know. The problem is we complicate it. Instead of just experiencing it clearly, and then not adding to it, which is a lot of what the shorter discourse on the lion's roar is around. What do we do? How can we approach that? Yeah, Rick.
As I work with this teaching more and more, and the work and trying to formulate my words here, is when we talk about experience, and that has to be broken down to how we actually work with experience and what it means in my own mind to say, oh, here's a discomfort. Mm-hmm. And so do we go into the discomfort to really understand the nature of it as sharpness, holding, tightness, or just that we stay on the edges of it and say it's discomfort. And in each of those places, the relationship of the mind is going to be changing and looking mm-hmm. at it from different angles. Mm-hmm. And in the getting of the knowing, the deeper we can know it, we act for myself and working with people, the deeper recognizing the releasing when the body releases it. And there's a relinquishment, and the mind is aware of that relinquishment. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's not me anymore. Mm-hmm. And it begins to see that. And mm-hmm. so for me, then it's like seeing, this is me. Then I begin to understand more of the self-creation of the relationship that I'm making to every object and every thought.
Right, exactly. And that's actually the important piece of that investigation, is that we get to the point of release and relinquishment, because we can keep finding more things to investigate or more angles to view it from. That feeds the whole process.
Feeds the emotion, because the fear. The fear is to actually go there, go see what it is, and go feel what it is, and that's like, no, why do I want to do that?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's sort of, yeah, but the only way out is through.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I wanted to, yeah, Manishe. I
just wanted to confirm from my experience, we're also not putting this self to other objects. Like the flower, the rose is red, and it, redness, that type of redness belongs to that rose. And so it may create preference for me and make me suffer if I don't have it, for example.
Yes, so yes, or that like it makes me suffer when those roses turn black and they're still on the shrine. Which happens all the time. Right, exactly. Because you can't extrapolate that out and say that's its true nature is, because it's going to change.
So it's not anything.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Things change, but can't that be part of its nature that it changes? I mean,
oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's the accepting of that allows things to be what they are.
Because, yeah. Yeah, I'm like, well, yeah, they change.
Yeah,
they
yeah, yeah.
It.
Yeah, get over. Yeah, get over it. Come on. Well, there isn't how it's because we pick and choose the things that we allow to change and the things we really don't want to change. And therein lies the problem. Okay, so, there'll be some people who have read the readings that we assigned. The Chula Sihanada Sutta, which is the shorter discourse on the lion's roar, and it's a sutta where the Buddha. I think it's important to. There's many reasons why I chose this sutta, but one of them is not to end up in an argument of is the Buddha sort of teaching exclusivity, and what he's pointing to is the because there's some discourses where the Buddha is explaining, some places where he's conciliatory, some places, and this is a place where he's. He's just sort of, here it is, and this is the way to do it, and go for it. But in order to penetrate to the goal. I mean, he says that his lion's roar is is that in his teachings there are other teachings and practices and whatnot but that they don't really take to the same goal that the Buddha is pointing to. And the liberation that the Buddha is pointing to is one that is predicated on an understanding of and being able to put into practice Let's say I'll just read from the when somebody says, "Well, what's the distinction? What's the difference between your practice and our practice?" And the Buddha says, "Wanderers of other sects who ask thus may be answered in this way: How then, friends, is the goal one or many? Answering rightly, the wanderers of other sects would answer thus: Friends, the goal is one, not many. But friends, is that goal for one affected by lust or free from lust? Answering rightly, the wanderers of other sects would answer: Friends, that goal is for one free from lust, not for one affected by lust. Similar is the goal for one affected by hate or free from hate. And of course, no, it's for one not affected by hate. Is the goal for one who is free from delusion and not for one affected by delusion? And of course, that's the purpose of it. This is one has to be free from delusion and not affected by delusion. Said, friends, is that goal for one affected by craving or free from craving? And I said, well, that goal has to be for one for who is free from craving. Is that goal for one affected by clinging or free from clinging? The goal has to be for one who is free from clinging. Is that goal for one who has vision or one without vision? It has to be one with vision, with, say, understanding, seeing things in their true nature. Is that goal for one who favors and opposes, or for one who does not favor and oppose? In the sense of liking, disliking, wanting, not wanting, this is right, that's wrong. All of those kind of back and forth. And then we said, no, the goal is for one who does not favor and oppose. Is the goal for one who delights in and enjoys proliferation, or for one who does not delight in and enjoy proliferation? Answering rightly, they would answer, friends, that goal is for one who does not delight in and enjoy proliferation, not for one who delights in and enjoys proliferation. And that, those are the kind of conditions or the things that we need to rely on, or the things that we have to relinquish or develop in order for the goal to really manifest. And then the Buddha goes on to point out an aspect around the way that the mind works. In a sense, there, because there are these two views, the view of being and the view of non-being. And the words in Pali are, say, bhavaditti, in the sense the view of a being, becoming, and vibhavaditti, the view of non-being or non-becoming. And again, these are views that are tend to create opposition, exclusivity. Any recluses or Brahmins who do not understand as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of these two views are affected by lust, affected by hate, affected by delusion, affected by craving, affected by clinging, without vision, given to favoring and opposing, and they delight in and enjoy proliferation. They are not freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. They are not free from suffering, I say. And so that is a basis for the, you say, what is it that obstructs? And of course, the Buddha does the opposite, and one who really understands the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, in the case of those views, and the view of being, the view of non-being, then that necessarily frees one from lust, hate, delusion, craving, clinging, blah, 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 all of that, freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, free from suffering. Then the Buddha goes on to the four types of clinging. And it's in these four types of clinging that he describes the... Because there's clinging to sensual desires, sensual pleasures, kama upadana, clinging to views, views, opinions, positions, clinging to rules and observances. It's in the sense that clinging to from the position that if I just kept this rule, if I just practiced in that way, if I just did this, then I'd be pure. That my purity can come from this particular thing. And then clinging to a doctrine of self. And it's important to see when the Buddha teaches about clinging, as it's not clinging to self, it's clinging to the assumption of self, the doctrine of self, the position of self. It's called attavad upadana. It's not atta upadana. Attavada upadana is sort of like the doctrine, the position, the assumption of self. So that it's a distinction that's really important because it's a different way of taking a position.
Could you say that attavada upadana is that very trying to say? Is it self or is it no self?
Absolutely. So absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Just getting trapped in the whole, is it self, is it not self, is it, you know, what is it? That in itself is that. So, clinging to a doctrine or position of self in some way, shape, or form. And then the Buddha goes on to sort of say, you know, there's certain recluses and Brahmins, and they teach and they experience the freedom from the clinging to sense desires, sense pleasures, but they don't understand the rest of it, to views, to rules and observances, to doctrines of self. And he goes through all of them, saying that there are teachings and practices that people do experience that teach the relinquishment of clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances. But it's what's unique to the Buddha's teachings is that it's in his teaching that he explains and describes a full understanding of this, of the clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, clinging to a doctrine of self, and that's his lion's roar and saying this is unique. This is important. This is something that isn't found elsewhere, but then he goes on and in the sutta. I mean, of course, he gives his kind of lion's roar, but then he also goes on, and then he uses. See these four kinds of clinging in a way to illustrate the dependent origination, and which is also another quite unique feature of his teaching, where the Buddha this analysis or pointing to causal processes, causes and conditions for the arising and the ceasing of things. And it's interesting in the sense that in the sutta, the Buddha starts with clinging. And now these four kinds of clinging have what is their source, what is their origin, what from what are they born and produced. These four kinds of clinging have craving as their source. And he traces it back. Craving has feeling as its source. Feeling has what? Feeling has contact as its source. And traces it back to ignorance. And throughout the suttas, the Buddha illustrates many of his teachings through dependent origination or through what's it? Idabhacayata. I don't know what it is. Huh? This that conditioning, it doesn't have to be, and often doesn't have to be the full-blown 12 links of the dependent origination chain. All it has to be is enough to point to the principle and point to some of the just the particular areas of that process that give you an opportunity to get a handle on that process. And because what's more important than, say, getting all the links right, it's understanding the principle. And it's kind of like what Ajahn Chah talks about it, in the sense that he says, you don't need to know all, follow every single link in the chain or follow it. You just have to understand how it works. So in the same way that if you've climbed up a tree and you fall down, you don't actually have to count all the branches as you're going down. You just have to know that when you hit the bottom, it's going to hurt. And that, you just, in that sense, okay, this is where it's going. And these causal processes are similar, understanding them. And I think what the the ability to the Buddha winds it up because when ignorance is abandoned, avijja is abandoned, and true knowledge has arisen in a bhikkhu, then with the fading away of ignorance and the arising of true knowledge, no longer clings to sensual pleasure, no longer clings to views, no longer clings to rules and observances, no longer clings to a doctrine of self. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he's not agitated, personally attains nibbana, understanding. Birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. And so that lion's roar sort of culminating in that, really seeing different forms of clinging, but really that we have to take it to the clinging of, to the doctrines of self, assumptions of self, positions of self, because that's where it really comes to its full ability to bring fruition. Yeah, Carol.
Do you think it's enough to just be aware of of the suffering that's, like in your experience, of the suffering that's caused by the clinging to the self, like just seeing that hurts? Is it enough to do that? Do you think, like, just to be mindful of that and eventually there'll be dispassion?
Not usually. I wouldn't think so. Maybe in some cases it might. You have to take that experience and extrapolate it in order to understand its implication and to take it down a bit deeper. and particularly that sense of because whether it's, say, impermanence or suffering, or even not self, it has to, we have to take it back to a place of, you know, of, yeah, of a subsiding and breaking through that avijja, lack of true knowledge, allowing true knowledge to arise and fostering that say vijja, and not just as a piece of information or a right doctrinal soundbite, but a real penetration and understanding. And then that allows the mind to really release.
Okay, so just to make sure I understand, so how about an experience where there is clinging and the ensuing suffering, and then just reflecting on the, you know, on it in each dukkha-anatta?
Mm-hmm.
Or just, I mean, because like you were saying earlier, like, you know, you can explore, you know, you can proliferate in your I can proliferate my exploration.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just wondering, yeah, like, how, like, you know, how to, you know, take it down a deeper place without proliferating.
I think the thing is the curbing the mind from the proliferation, in that sense of delighting in non-proliferation, where one is, because the mind wants to label, it wants to analyze, it wants to create something out of it, it wants to, oh, woe is me, or, you know, it wants to create a story. So then to be able to, no, just stay with that, delighting in that non-proliferation. And then things start to happen. So it's that but there's a stillness. It's like you know, the best or the most efficacious investigation comes from a still mind. It isn't just putting the labels of, you know, getting the right labels on the, oh, this is impermanent, this is suffering, and this is not self. It's when the mind is really still and clear, and then there's associations are being made, and there's a releasing and relinquishing that starts to happen. And obviously, we sometimes need to prod the mind with a conceptual framework of anatta or anicca or this is causal process, but it's coming back to stillness that is the important part. Yeah.
Just what you said reminds me of the resin.
Yes, it's that sticky bit that creates the problems. So it's just being able to recognize and understand how we, because we do. We love a good story. We're at a loss when we don't have a sense of me being something or me not being something. So that's where that the Buddha said that bhava ditti vibhava ditti, that standpoint, that view, that position that we take of in a place of either being, becoming, being something, or not being, in a sense of pushing it away, annihilating it, negating it, and to just be present it's so hard, but it's so simple, and you sort of think, oh, there must be more to this than that, you know. But it's you realize, wow, if it really was simple, why can't I do it? So that encouraging oneself in that saying, yeah, okay, what where is the movement? And where is the stillness? That's one of the things that I oftentimes reflect with, is that really attending to that juxtaposition of a stillness and movement. Because it's not as if one is right and one's wrong, because we can be still and really dull, the mind can move with real clarity and acuity. But it's sort of that stillness and movement, where does it, what's generating it, what's pushing it? And that bhavaditti, vibhavaditti is the engine behind it. And of course that's your force behind this arising of a sense of self, a sense of me. John.
Well, before I can get to all that,
it was like Hector at the break. He said, "You should just teach about the five precepts."
But in the meantime, I found some things useful, like this one. I can feel that coming up, interfering with my life.
Yeah.
I think about what Ajahn Sumedho said somewhere in one of his books. He said, "Every time I think of myself, I get depressed."
Yeah. Perfect.
Really useful. Getting into this place now, and what am I doing? And that kind of just cuts right through to the.
Yeah.
But it doesn't get me to the place you're talking about. It's not like a deep reflection, but it's kind of a band-aid.
Yeah.
Or, it's also sort of a motivation to take that on, because if that helps, then better way to be a truly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's important to recognize that, because once when you pick up a little bit of it, and you realize, wow, there's real possibilities here, and so it's it inspires the mind, it really uplifts the heart, and then also sort of seeing, well, it's not. All that. I mean, it's difficult, but it's not that complicated. That's one of the things that with the Buddha's teachings, is there's a directness to it that allows us to sort of see, even though, yes, it goes against the grain, and we've got all this conditioning habits, but, the essence of it is quite simple. And sometimes one of the most difficult things for us to do is actually to choose the simple. There's a certain sort of pull or a fascination with what is a bit more complicated or. Yes, Rick.
Yeah, something that I keep trying to relate to this is noticing how the mind the mind defends suffering. It'll defend it because it's so closely related to that idea of self.
Yeah.
So it'll defend it, and it has to let go of defending.
Yeah.
And then that means, well, then what am I?
Well, right.
Defending something.
Yeah. If I'm nothing. but again, that's where we make these stances. We take these stances on things that are ultimately so. Okay, yeah, there isn't really a foundation to that. So that's an important piece of the puzzle in how to. To use these teachings, to use this again, that's that emphasis that this is a strategy as opposed to it's not an epistemology. The theory of, it's not a theory of knowledge, it's sort of, this is a strategy. Of course, the goal is always freedom from suffering. Yeah, Karina.
I'm not sure if I'm understanding right, but the Bala Dityos, is it the same word in cultivation?
It's same root.
Same.
Bhava means to bring into being. So like bhavana is the word for cultivation. So the root is the same. Bhavana means to bring into being. Say bhava is being. So like to bhavana is to bring into being. Cultivation, development. So like the cultivation of the mindfulness, to cultivate the development, to bring into being the meditation object. So it's the same root, but different applications. Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of missed when you used those words also, because you were talking about, like, when the mind is really still.
Yeah.
And then there starts to be some movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like you're saying, like, pay attention to what is bringing up this becoming.
Yeah.
This
self-becoming,
that's what you were...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wasn't familiar enough with the quality to get that last piece. But
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
It is.
It is. Yeah. Okay. Why don't we have another little break? Allow our minds to regel again after being melted.